You are listening to the Professional Education Broadcast Network. Thank you for joining us for Ethics of Representing Two Parties in a Transaction. I am pleased to introduce our speakers today. Joining us from Tysons Corner, Virginia, is Tom Spahn. Mr. Spahn is of counsel in the Tysons Corner's Virginia office of McGuire Woods, where he advises firm clients on professional responsibility issues and properly creating and preserving the attorney-client privilege and work product protections. He has served on the ABA Standing Committee on Ethics and Professional Responsibility and is a member of the American Law Institute and a fellow of the American Bar Foundation. He has written extensively on attorney-client privilege, ethics, and other topics, and has spoken at over 2,000 CLE programs throughout the U.S. and in several foreign countries. Through links on his website biography, he has made available to the public his summaries of over 1,600 Virginia and ABA legal ethics opinions organized by topic, a 300-page summary of his two-volume, 1,500-page book on the attorney-client privilege and work product doctrine, over 900 weekly email alerts about privilege and work product cases, and materials for 40 ethics programs on numerous topics totaling over 9,000 pages of analysis. Mr. Spahn will serve as the discussion leader of today's program. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Elizabeth Simon. Ms. Simon is an Assistant General Counsel for Ethics at Akin Gump Strauss Hauer & Feld, LLP, where she advises on ethics and compliance-related matters to support Akin's offices worldwide. Previously, her practice focused on business and commercial litigation and providing counsel to attorneys regarding legal ethics and professional liability. Ms. Simon is a current chair of the District of Columbia Rules of Professional Conduct Review Committee and the former chair of the District of Columbia Legal Ethics Committee. She is a member of the ABA Center for Professional Responsibility, CLE Committee, and the New York State Bar Association Committee on Professional Discipline. She is an adjunct professor at the Georgetown Law. Ms. Simon writes and speaks extensively on attorney ethics issues. Mr. Spahn, I hand the program over to you.
Great. Thank you, operator. Thanks to Nate Trelease for lining this up, and thanks for letting me speak with Liz. Liz really is a super walk-the-walk kind of ethics lawyer. I write about it a lot, but she actually is chair of some committees that have to make rule decisions and in other areas as well. And I always learn a lot more than I teach when I'm with Liz. So let me tell you what we're going to cover here, the ethics of representing two parties in a transaction. Liz will start with the core issues, which are what is the information flow when you have multiple clients, and how do you deal with conflicts of interest? That's the loyalty issue, and that's always the thing that you got to focus most on. I will then talk a little bit about the counseling clients and sharing confidential information and its implications with each other, which Liz will cover, but also with third parties. So it's easy when you have multiple people in transactions to forget that some of them aren't clients of the same lawyer. Liz will then talk about drafting a conflict of interest waivers, which takes care of the loyalty issue and also usually the information flow issue that she's going to give the basic principles on. I will then talk about privilege issues involved in joint representations. That's the evidentiary privilege. Liz will then cover what to do when jointly representing clients disagree. That can be tricky. And then if there's time, I'll talk a little bit about negotiation ethics when representing multiple clients. But I hope we run out of time because Liz will have covered the other stuff. So Liz, let me turn it over to you for the core of this program.
Great. Thanks, Tom. And I always enjoy working with you too, because you write all the materials, so it makes it really easy for the rest of us. But I wanted to start with talking about information flows and potential conflicts of interest. And I always start these programs with a general caveat. And the first caveat is, you know, the standard disclaimer that, you know, I'm always speaking on behalf of myself and my own, you know, knowledge and interest in ethics, and not on behalf of my firm or any of the committees that I represent. But the other thing that's always important to keep in mind at the outset is that I primarily focus on the ADA model rules of professional conduct, which have been adopted in you know, every U.S. jurisdiction now. But there are significant modifications in various jurisdictions on these issues. The conflicts rules are not the same in every jurisdiction. So it's always important to consult with your local ethics rules, the cases interpreting those, and with your local bar if you have questions, you know, that are specific to the areas and the states in which you practice. I certainly know the states where I practice, and I still go back and look to the rules, even though I kind of do this for a living. So let's talk about joint representations and information flows. You know, really the first step in any joint representation is identifying your client. And it's really the important step, and it's important to do it up front so that you have a representation that can proceed as smoothly as possible. So sometimes a joint representation is just literally about two people working jointly on something, but it can also be multiple parties. They can arise in a number of contexts. You know, for example, in litigation, there may be groups of aligned plaintiffs or aligned defendants who want to be represented by a single attorney. This can be seen as a money saver because having one attorney who's familiar with all of the issues can often, you know, get to the heart of matters that are common to the group more efficiently and more cost effectively. And where joint representations, of course, can become complicated is when you start to consider conflicts rules. If an attorney is representing multiple people, the attorney has to determine at the outset whether they can do that without significant risk that the lawyer's professional judgment on behalf of any of the clients in the group would be adversely affected. In any joint representation, a lawyer has to, you know, also set out the possible consequences of joint representations, which include the advantages and disadvantages of representing more than one person. The kinds of situations that might cause the interests of one client to diverge from the interests of the other client and how likely it is that that might happen. And then the harm that might happen or result if the lawyer is forced to withdraw from the representation, which could include things like delay, expense, and then the, you know, potential for the loss of the attorney-client privilege among clients in the joint representation. And then disputes in the future, which are all things that we'll talk about through this program. And, you know, whether, and this is oftentimes the most important question, you know, as a result of a conflict, does the attorney have to withdraw from representing one of the clients, all of the clients, or can they stay on in some instances? And what impacts does that have on things like privilege and stuff like that? It's usually advisable at the start of a joint representation to remind everybody that they always have the right and they are entitled to have separate lawyers if they want them. They may already know this, but it's always good to tell them anyway. And sometimes, depending on the circumstances, it may be advisable to let the client know that they also have the right to consult with another attorney before agreeing to a joint representation. But one of the most important pieces to cover at the outset and for the lawyer to really think about, you know, intensely is information flows. In other words, what is the information that gets shared or not shared, as it may be, between the joint clients? And there's a couple of different approaches, and I'm going to go through those. So the first approach is what happens when there is no agreement upfront about sharing information. All joint or multiple representations have to deal with information flow. So very often a lawyer in a joint representation will be approached by one of the parties who really wants to tell the lawyer something and doesn't want the information shared with the other parties. So there's, like I said before, three different situations. What happens when there's no discussion at the start of the representation regarding sharing? When there is an agreement in advance that the lawyer will not share secrets among the group. And then the third situation is when the lawyer has an agreement in advance that the lawyer will share secrets between and among client group. A good risk management tip for anybody who engages in joint representations is to have this conversation up front. I can't stress that enough. And by upfront, I mean before the representation begins. It may not solve every problem to have that upfront agreement because clients can and do sometimes change their minds midstream, but at least it helps to minimize the risk and provides guidance to the attorney. And it also sets expectations for the clients as to what's going to happen. Another recommendation is to make sure that whatever arrangement is made, that you include it in the engagement or the waiver letter so that it's memorialized in writing, and the client's agreement is also memorialized in writing. And I'll be talking about that a little bit later. The ABA model rules advise lawyers to arrange for a no secrets approach to a joint representation. And the commentary to Model Rule 1.7 says that the lawyer should advise clients that information will be shared and that the lawyer will have to withdraw if one of the clients decides that some of the matter, if it's material to the representation, should be kept from the other clients. And materiality is a pretty important piece of this. You know, if the client wants to come in and talk to the lawyer about something completely different that has nothing to do with the case, that is not necessarily something that's going to destroy a joint representation. If it's, on the other hand, a matter where, you know, nobody is assuming liability or nobody is accepting responsibility for something, and one of the clients comes in and says, yeah, I did it, but you can't tell the others, that's a problem. So how these things get handled is really important. So having no agreement creates a pretty tricky and risky situation. If there's no agreement and the issue comes up later that the client has material information regarding the representation, the lawyer needs to figure out what to do with that. So the first step, obviously, is to take a look at your local ethics rules for guidance. And there are a number of ethics opinions out there that talk about what approach is, you know, is best and what should be done in when you don't have an agreement. Now, in the District of Columbia, we have specific comments to Rule 1.7 that talk about common or joint representations. And when it comes to communication, the DC Bar says, with regard to the attorney-client privilege, the prevailing rule is that, as between commonly represented parties, the privilege does not attach. Hence, it must be assumed if litigation happens between the clients, the privilege will not protect the communications between them, and the clients should be so advised. So as to confidentiality, DC takes the position that a continued joint representation will almost certainly be inadequate and won't work at all if one client asks the lawyer not to disclose to the other client information that is relevant to the representation. And this is because, like Tom said at the outset, the lawyer has an equal duty of loyalty to each client in the client group, and each client has the right to be informed of anything that bears on the representation if it might affect their interests, and also the right that the lawyer will use any information that the lawyer learns for that client's benefit. And that also we find in the rules regarding communication with clients, and that's Rule 1.4, which talks about communication. DC recognizes that a joint representation in and of itself doesn't alter a fundamental ethical obligation to keep secrets and confidences, though. So there's a natural tension there. As most of us realize, Rule 1.6, which deals with confidentiality, sets out that, you know, information we learn in the representation of a client is confidential. And a joint representation alters that. But here, again, as we're talking about in this scenario, we don't have an agreement between the clients up front as to what's going to happen to that information. So it can get very, very tricky very quickly. So in the absence of an agreement that allows for sharing of this information that we've learned, the lawyer may have no choice but to withdraw when there's no sharing information, understanding there. So again, you know, that's why bars like DC and other states recommend that the lawyer at the outset, you know, gets informed consent, informs clients that information will be shared, and explains what happens if something changes along the way and a client later objects to that representation. Now, Florida, in contrast, issued an ethics opinion a couple of years ago that said that lawyers did not have to address the information flow issue at the beginning of a representation. However, the analysis there underscored why addressing the issue is important, because what the opinion says is that the attorney must withdraw because one party's desire to have the lawyer keep a secret creates a conflict. So they all come to the same result through different analysis, but at the end of the day, it's the same result. You may end up having to withdraw. So there's also a risk of discipline. Attorneys have been subject to discipline for failing to explain to jointly represented clients that information would be shared. And explaining that there is a conflict or a conflict might require withdrawal is not enough without being more specific that the issue is sharing information. Lawyers are required to advise clients that the information would be available to each client, that it would be exchanged between them because of our duties of communication. So in this one case, when the investigation by the lawyer uncovered information that was helpful to the client and it hurt the other client, essentially it revealed who committed the crime. The lawyer refused to release the information without both of the client's consents. And one of the clients didn't consent. And I'm pretty sure it was the guy who did it, but, you know, it didn't say. And the disciplinary authorities took issue with the fact that the lawyer didn't have an upfront agreement because they believed that the lawyer would have had, would have been able to get that agreement upfront if the issue had been fully explained to the clients. So the ABA and other courts and bars recognize that if there isn't an agreement, then the lawyer can't share the information. There may be other exceptions under Rule 1.6, which does give certain exceptions to confidentiality in very narrow circumstances. But those exceptions are really the exception and not the rule when it comes to representing your clients. Another example about information sharing will often come up when you're representing insureds. Many states have this concept called the tripartite relationship. And that is that the defense counsel has a relationship with both the carrier and the insured. And that also means generally, you know, it's at least implied that there'll be information sharing with the carrier if you're defending the insured. But it's important to have those conversations again up front. Because something could happen if the insured tells the attorney something that would impact his insurance coverage. Well, even if there is an agreement to share information or in this case, there's been no conversation, the rule of thumb is that, you know, your duty is to your client and the insurance company is not necessarily your client. And that again can create a conflict that, requires the attorney to withdraw. So it's important to have that conversation. Now there's other jurisdictions that recognize the default rule that in the absence of an agreement, there are no secrets. This is the same position that the restatement of the law regarding lawyers has taken. And whether those obligations of disclosure are mandatory or merely allowable is open to debate. But what the restatement says is that it considers the sharing of information to be normal and typically expected. And the theory there is that as co-clients, there's a fiduciary duty as between the clients to share information that's material to the joint representation. Information would be shared with each other, but not with other third parties, which is something Tom will talk about. And the restatement finds that the no secrets approach, you know, can still be consistent with obligations under our duty of communication to keep clients informed. But a lot of it really does depend on individual state law and what your state's ethics rules say. Now, continuing on sort of a survey across some of the states, there's an ethics opinion in New Jersey that recognizes that a lawyer has some discretion about whether or not to keep information secret. The retainer letter, that was at issue in this ethics opinion, said that information could become available to the other, but didn't explicitly require the sharing of information. And here, this was a family law case, and the issue was that the father had a child outside of the marriage. The wife didn't know about this other child. The lawyer found out about the information from a third party, who was not the client, And the court didn't address whether the duty to disclose was mandatory or discretionary, but it clearly didn't require that the information be kept secret. So, you know, there was no impact to the lawyer for sharing the information. Now, Maryland has also addressed this issue, but in the context of privilege for formally represented parties, and there have a legal ethics opinion that held that a lawyer that was fired by one of the two jointly represented parties and the parties became adverse to each other, had to withdraw from representing both clients, even if the client consented to, you know, the lawyer staying on for one of them. And the former client was then allowed access to the client's files because of the joint representation. And there's also, you know, case law in other states, including Nevada, where, you know, that can happen if jointly represented parties disagree, which is a topic that we'll talk about a little bit later. So, you know, if the lawyer doesn't have an explicit agreement up front, you know, kind of summing this up, it's best to check with your local ethics rules and cases and maybe to make a call to your ethics hotline to figure out the best answer. But in the absence of clear guidance, you know, the default of keeping the secret should apply if we don't have an agreement to the contrary. And if that's the case, then the attorney has to consider whether you have to withdraw if you're asked to keep a secret or if there's another approach that might work. When you do have an agreement, an overt agreement at the beginning to keep secrets, you're not really, you know, while it's a joint representation, it's not really a joint representation. It's more of a separate representation where you're representing more than one party. And if you agree that there's no secret sharing, then you have to follow that arrangement, you know, again, and if a conflict becomes evident, you may have to withdraw. So the clients can agree upfront that you won't share information. This will sometimes come up in trade secret cases or other kinds of proprietary or intellectual property type matters where clients have information that is material to them or important to them, but not necessarily information that needs to be shared, even in things like a joint venture. And keeping secrets in those cases may not create a conflict because you could make an argument that it's not material to the representation. However, like I said before, in other contexts, you know, there is a higher risk for conflicts if the secrets are kept. And for example, if there's financial information that's kept secret, a conflict can arise if the lawyer reviewing the information finds that the client is insolvent. And obviously that would have some impact on whatever deal that the clients are trying to do together. If not disclosing this information would mislead the other client or might assist the client in committing a fraud or other, you know, a crime, then it would be mandatory for the attorney to withdraw. Not only from a conflicts perspective, because the information is adverse to the other client, but because of a just general ethical obligation that we can't be using our services to assist a client in committing a crime or a fraud. And again, I'll you know, note back to DC's rule 1.7 conflict rules, because it's instructive on this point. It says under limited circumstances, a lawyer can find it appropriate to have a joint representation where the clients agree after being properly informed that the lawyer will keep confidential and, you know, keep information confidential. They may reasonably conclude that trade secrets will not adversely affect representation. And with informed consent, you can do that. The restatement of the law also recognizes that co-clients can agree that certain information isn't going to be shared with each other. But that will not insulate the lawyer, even with that agreement, from conflicts, and still could result in the need to withdraw if a conflict arises. So with those two scenarios out of the way, let's talk about the one that comes up most commonly in joint representations before I turn it back over to Tom about how do you counsel your clients on all of these complicated scenarios, which is the no secrets approach. And that is the default approach under the ABA rules and under many state rules, is that if you have a joint representation, the understanding is that there will be sharing. And so if the clients agree that there will be no be sharing, then you have to, again, honor that agreement. And most of the time that works just fine. Where it goes sort of sideways is when the clients agree up front to having that sharing approach, and then one later asks the lawyer to keep a secret. The commentary to the ABA model will say that you have to withdraw if a client decides that something that's material to the representation will be kept from the other person. So if there's an agreement that there are no secrets, you know, what does the lawyer do with that information when they withdraw? Are they required to tell? Are they required to keep it confidential? Fortunately, the ABA in 2008 actually wrote an ethics opinion on this, and that's ethics opinion 450. And it says that the lawyers must keep the confidence absent an express agreement to the contrary. However, it still really doesn't answer the question, because there was an express agreement back at the beginning that information was going to be shared. And that's where, you know, that informed consent kind of comes into play. And there is no clear answer to what to do. Some people will just say you keep the secret and you withdraw and you maintain the confidentiality. And other people will say you can share the information, because that was the deal at the outset. But we also recognize that informed consent and client consent can be withdrawn. So you have to consider that as well. Advanced consents, which is what we get when we have an upfront agreement, may not be fully informed. And that's because you may not fully recognize at the outset the conflicts that could be created, because you don't know what the information is. So if you don't know what the information is, you know, how can the clients give their fully informed consent? And that's a common attack tactic, you know, just advanced waivers in general. So in that kind of a scenario, it's highly doubtful that, you know, any waiver would be considered informed if that kind of a dispute arose. And practically speaking, clients change their minds all the time. And you know, how that impacts a representation is also something that needs to be considered. So as I said, you know, while the ABA opinion from 2008 didn't quite answer the question of what do you do with the information, you know, DC has said you share the information. New York has said that a lawyer in this circumstance must share the information, because the clients agreed in advance that the lawyer would do it. But again, that opinion doesn't solve the issue of, well, the clients now change their minds. So how does that change the landscape? You know, so there are a lot of twists on these information flow issues. And as we'll talk about through the rest of the program, you know, the important piece is, you know, having conversations with clients about these issues and getting as informed a consent as you possibly can. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Tom, who's going to talk about how do you counsel your clients about all of these different scenarios and what they mean to them. So, Tom?
Great. Thanks, Liz. And yeah, great job on describing just how confusing this is, because there's difference from state to state. And my advice, and I'm sure your advice at Akin Gump, is to hardly ever let there be a default position analysis required, because just make sure that the clients understand what the information flow will be, which is the hardest part, much more difficult than the loyalty part, I think. And you have to rub their nose in it. I know that sounds kind of ugly, but imagine a client being told, well, it's right here in, you know, paragraph 75 that we were going to share the fact that you had an illegitimate child. So did you read that? All of us who have bought houses will have to admit I've never read the mortgage agreements before buying a house. So you have to rub their nose in it and make sure that they fully understand that. And even then, I think just emotionally, it's difficult. And we've dealt with this where somebody told us, one of, it wasn't me, luckily, one of my colleagues And then my colleague said, well, you know, I've got to tell your wife about that. It was the husband in the case that I'm thinking of. And he said, oh, my God, no, I can't. You can't. Please don't tell her. And they it was the other way around, I guess. But anyway, though, and we said, well, it's right here. And he said, I didn't read the darn thing. And yet you've got a contract where they did that. And so you've got to sort of comply with it, I guess. If you can talk yourself into not complying, that might help you kind of emotionally. And the other thing to make it even more complicated, Liz, I know you probably deal with this too, is it can be not just all or nothing. In other words, when we represent a company and an executive who says that he never groped a secretary, we usually will say, listen, fella, you're telling us you didn't grope your secretary. That's fine. And we believe you, but we're not going to call you every, we don't say it quite this way. We're not going to call you every time we talk to the general counsel of the company. We will give you the material information you need to make informed decisions about the litigation, but so that's it. So that's an uneven information flow. It's not all or nothing. But Liz said the other thing to keep in mind here, I'll just very briefly explain that just how fragile the privilege is, which I'm going to get to a little bit later, but also how risky it is for people that are sharing information, because it's not just one client. It's almost easier to understand for the client to understand to say, I've got my lawyer and nobody else is, I'm going to meet secretly with my lawyer and he's not here, she's not going to say anything. But when you have multiple clients who are sharing information, they have to realize just how fragile the privilege is on the waiver side. And I'm not going to talk now about the within the joint representation. That creates its own, which I'll get to a little bit later for a few minutes. But outside the joint representation, and just let me give you some examples. Even family members are outside for privilege purposes, outside the attorney-client privilege. And the examples I give you, Martha Stewart waived the privilege by giving something to her own daughter. The same would be true sometimes of a wife or a husband, although the spousal privilege, which is either statutory or rule-based, usually avoids a waiver in that case. But bringing, let me just give you an example that happened out in Colorado where Dana, maybe Stephanie is. This is a 35 or 30-year-old woman who suffered a stroke at a chiropractor's office. Her parents brought her to the doctor, and then they accompany her to a lawyer. She's thinking of hiring a lawyer. And so it brings the parents there, and the defendant, the chiropractor, finds out that she talked to the lawyer. She didn't end up hiring that lawyer and says, well, your parents were there. They were outsiders, so it was not privileged because they were outsiders. And she said, well, wait a minute. I had a stroke, for God's sake. They needed me. I needed them to be there. And the Colorado Supreme Court, which is not kind of a brutal Supreme Court, it's pretty mild, said, yeah, you're right. They were inside work product protection, which is different, but you didn't claim that, lawyer. You should have done that. So she waived the privilege by having her own parents there. And so with joint clients who are going to be sharing information, protected information, totally protected, with other people, have to be warned not to share with all other people because the privilege is so fragile. So Liz, let me turn it back to you to talk about drafting conflict or waivers to try to get them to implement what decision they make after you counseled them as you did the first go round of your talk. So back to you.
Sure. Thanks, Tom. And this is you know, issue of conflict of interest waivers. I hate to put it this way, but it's sort of like near and dear to my heart because on the other, you know, and on the more negative side, it's also the bane of my existence. I spend a great deal of my time talking about conflicts of interest, resolving conflicts of interest, whether they can be resolved and preventing them. And the thing to remember about a conflict of interest waiver is it's while we call it waiver, it's not really a waiver because it doesn't make the conflict of interest go away. What it does is it informs everybody of the issue and it gets their consent to proceed anyway. And that's why, you know, it can be in some ways fragile because a client can always change their mind and withdraw their waiver. But on the other hand, a lawyer has a absolute right to rely on the fact that an informed client told them that something was okay. And, you know, if they change their minds midstream, you know, the lawyer has in some instances some recourse anyway, because, you know, they proceeded with a different, you know, on a different landscape. But let's talk about drafting an effective waiver. And I use air quotes around the word waiver, but drafting an effective consent and waiver document that in a joint representation sets out what you need to tell your clients and what they need to understand in order for you to have a good position that you got fully informed consent from people. And the first thing really is consider your audience. Are they sophisticated business people who are, you know, frequent dabblers in the land of lawyers and legal issues? Because what they need to understand in a waiver scenario may be very different than what, you know, an unsophisticated user of legal services needs to understand in order to get to the same point. That's not to say that a individual or a small business or you know, a simple like mom and pop kind of shop can't give an effective waiver. It just means that you may need to do a little bit of extra work to make sure that they have all of the information they need to make an informed decision. So, what is a conflict of interest waiver? Well, basically, it's a disclosure and informed consent. And you know, so it contains a couple of different elements. Now, in a joint representation context, you know, a good waiver will, you know, start out by saying what a joint representation is and what it means. And, you know, some of that precatory language that I used kind of at the top of the program where I said, you know, it can lead to efficiencies. And there can be advantages to all of the parties being able to communicate with each other freely and have a common counsel who understands sort of the big picture. So you are explaining their risks and the advantages of the joint representation. So if those are the advantages of the joint representation, what are the risks? The risks are that the interests of the parties might diverge at some point, at some unknown point for some unknown reason. Because if you know at the outset that it's likely that these people are not going to be all rowing in the same direction, then you have to really consider as an attorney whether a joint representation is right in the first instance. And in most authorities, and the weight of most authorities, the answer will be no. If there's a very, you know, obvious point where you think everybody's going to go in a different direction, then you just don't go down that road at all, because the downsides to the clients for having to find new counsel, hire new people, get them up to speed, and all of the costs incurred in that is not going to endear you to your clients. And it may open you up to malpractice and discipline because you saw a conflict and you kind of glossed it over. So you lay out the risks and benefits of this joint representation. And then you kind of get into the nuts and bolts of how it works. And that's that information sharing piece that I talked about before. You should talk to your clients and do it. It will depend in some part on what the case is about. You know, if it's a normal representation, you know, the kinds of the default of a sharing secrets approach, may be the most appropriate one. But if you know, for example, that it's, you know, a trade secrets case or an intellectual property case or a market share case. So and based on that, you know, based on your knowledge and experience, you understand that there may be issues or documents or market information that people might not want to share. You should talk to the clients about that and get their views up front, because again, If they're sophisticated users of legal services, they're going to know or at least have a basic understanding of some of this stuff. So if there's information like that, you know, you can have a share information approach and carve out that kind of information as not material to the representation. And I think that's perfectly allowable. But the idea of putting it in the conflict of interest waiver is that you're putting it in writing. You're putting it out there up front, and you're getting everyone to agree to a common understanding. And the benefit of that is twofold. First, you have something in writing, which is always a good thing. If you ever need to defend your actions or your thought process, but two, you're getting, you know, the client to look at it, not just in a verbal conversation, but you're getting the client to, you know, think about it and memorialize it and sign off on it. Now, not every state requires that a waiver be in writing. The number of jurisdictions that are moving towards having written waivers is increasing. But there's lots of different approaches to waivers. You know, for example, in New York, it's perfectly fine to send a confirming waiver. And in, if you're confirming a conversation or something like that. On the other hand, in California, it requires the client to actually respond back with their consent. So when we're talking about a joint representation and the best practice, which is, you know, sorting all of this out up front, because you really can't do it on the fly halfway through the case, put it in the engagement letter. And because it's a joint representation, you'll have an engagement letter that is going to every party to the joint representation. It sets out the pluses and minuses of joint representations. It sets out the information flow. It sets out what will happen in the event of a conflict. And everybody signs off on that engagement letter, and therefore they've all signed off on that waiver, and you've got it in writing and you've got it signed. And by signing, you know, that can come in different ways. It can be DocuSign. It can be ink. It can be an email that says, I agree, or, you know, however that's, you know, whatever is appropriate in your jurisdiction is fine to document that consent. But it's important to kind of to lay that stuff out in a manner that makes sense. And there are great examples out there. There are examples, you know, from many bar associations on what a joint representation waiver looks like. California has some. I've seen them from other states. And, you know, many insurance companies have waiver samples that you can find on their websites or even just with a Google search. But, you know, putting it in writing is really key, and putting it in the engagement letter is probably a best practice. So with that, I will turn it over to Tom to talk about some of the attorney-client privilege issues, because that's a super important thing to keep in mind, too.
Great. Yeah. Thanks, Liz. It's different from the confidentiality duty that you've been discussing. The privilege is much narrower. It just covers communications with a client or sometimes with third parties that are assisting you, the lawyer, very occasionally assist third parties that are assisting the client. That's pretty rare. But it does not cover the broad scope of the confidentiality duty that Liz has been talking about. So the privilege is narrower, but it's equally important, like you said, because it's the evidentiary protection that prevents third parties from figuring out what you've been talking about. So let me just give you some of the basic rules, and I'll turn it back to Liz about what happens when joint clients disagree. You think everything's complicated when they agree. It's even worse when they disagree. First, of course, it's not a privilege waiver when joint clients talk to each other. They can talk to each other and have it be not a waiver as long as it relates to either what they're communicating with their lawyer or what they're going to communicate with their lawyer. If they talk to each other about other stuff that's not related to the legal advice that they're going to seek or that they've got, then that wouldn't even be privileged to begin with. It wouldn't really be a waiver. But if you talk to, let's say, the husband and the wife misses the meeting and you're representing them both in an estate plan, the husband can go back and report to the wife himself about what was talked about with a lawyer with you, and that would not be a waiver. There is a question about who can waive the privilege that belongs to the joint clients. And for instance, let's say you represent three business people and they're planning a business, and they're all three of the clients. What if one of them goes out and blabs at a bar? Does that waive the privilege if it's intentional, not unintentional? And Liz, I don't know how you think. I've always thought the answer is no. It takes unanimity to wave it. Otherwise, it's so fragile that any one of the clients, if you have, let's say, 10 or 15 clients, one of them can go destroy the privilege by disclosing it. You wouldn't think so. And I've always thought the general rule was that an individual client, just one of the clients, cannot waive the privilege. But June 16th of this year, you may have read it already, Liz, the Supreme Court of North Carolina issued an opinion that says just the opposite. That involved Holland & Knight, which is another big law firm, represented a company and an executive individual. They claimed that that there was a question about whether they did or didn't represent them. But the Supreme Court kind of analyzed and said, no, it was a joint representation, sure enough. And therefore, as a result of that, I'll just read it. Based on the finding, the trial court properly determined that the individual jointly held the attorney-client privilege with respect to some call and therefore may opt to waive the privilege if he so desires, which to me is just absolutely wrong. I've always thought it takes unanimity of the joint clients to do that. So there's pretty important differences among the states, obviously, for sure. And let me also mention, I've already talked about the fragility of when family members are involved, that can waive the privilege as well. But take a few minutes to distinguish joint representations, which Liz has been doing such a good job explaining, from a common interest agreement. In a joint representation, the same lawyer represents multiple clients. I mean, that's hard enough to understand and apply and to figure out the information flow and the loyalty. But that's different from a common interest or joint defense agreement where everybody has their own lawyer. When everybody has their own lawyer, it's not a joint representation. But they can occasionally, very rarely, agree that they can share information among the separately represented clients as part of a common interest or joint defense or community of interest. It's called different things agreement. Which would otherwise be a waiver because they're outsiders. They're not that they don't represented by the same lawyer. They each have their own lawyer. I think lawyers are so arrogant, frankly, that they think they can contractually avoid the law that is the normal fragility of the privilege, the normal waiver that occurs. Even like I said, when Martha Stewart talks to her daughter about it, that was a waiver. And the other family members, that Colorado example I gave you, with the parents' presence destroying what would otherwise be privileged. But we think somehow that we can contractually, with a common interest agreement, avoid that. And normally we can't. I triage all the privilege cases every month from every court. There's about a box I get every month. I don't summarize them all anymore because I don't have the resources, but I check them all. And half of the common interest agreements fail. So don't assume that you can say, well, let's just agree no waiver. The law will determine if there's a waiver, not you. There's got to be some of them each have to have a lawyer. I mean, in most courts, not all courts, everybody's got to have his own lawyer, his or her own lawyer. They have to have an identical legal interest, not an identical emotional interest or an identical business interest, but identical legal interest. And sometimes some courts require the lawyers to be part of the conversation to avoid a waiver. So don't think that despite it's so tempting to just say, well, let's agree to a common interest agreement. Don't assume it's going to work because half of them don't work. And that will mean that the privilege has been waived. Now, it may not be a subject matter waiver. That is, it may not require you to produce more stuff unless you're going to use the privileged information or communications in a way to gain some advantage as a sword, then you can't use it as a shield. So that's the privilege risks, which are maybe even greater than the ethics risk, but you don't lose, all you lose is the evidence protection and the privilege side. You're not going to be disciplined, as Liz just mentioned. So back to you about what happens when everything gets even worse and the joint clients disagree, Liz.
Yeah. And thanks, Tom. And I recognize, that is a tough question. And some of those privilege questions can be a little tricky with common interest agreements, particularly. But what happens, when your joint representation starts to fall apart? And it could be one of those scenarios I mentioned before, like when the client comes to you and says, My co-client is the one who actually robbed the bank, but don't tell him I told you. you know, the answer in many of these cases is that, you know, you will have to withdraw, but, you know, it's not always as easy as that, because you have to sort of unpack what happens. And like Tom said earlier, you know, when you are have a joint representation where the clients have agreed to share information, the fact that the joint representation fell apart doesn't, you know, insulate that information from being used. The parties to the joint representation can still use it, even if they're not jointly represented anymore. Even if they're, you know, adverse to each other, they can, you know, they can't unknow what they know. But this, you know, comes up very practically, and it comes up frequently. And the answer for the lawyer most of the time when the joint clients start to diverge is that the lawyer has to figure out whether they have to withdraw from the entire case, whether they can stay on for one client and not the other, or, you know, whether the conflict that has come up is something that could be further waived with further informed consents. You know, and that rarely works in my personal opinion, but, you know, sometimes it's worth a try. But the question is one of preparation. You know, the hindsight is, did you look at this representation and realize that this could happen? And if it seemed obvious that it was going to happen, you know, did you adequately discharge your duties in taking this on? And that's sort of the malpractice disciplinary angle to it. But the reality is that, again, as part of that joint representation disclosure, that waiver that you get up front, you can also talk to the client about what will happen if let's just assume two parties no longer agree. In some instances, you know, the reason why you got into the joint representation is that client A is a longtime client of the firm, and they say, can you do this jointly with me and B? We're all got the same interests, and, you know, we want one attorney to do this. You can write an engagement letter that says, in the event of a dispute between you, we will continue as counsel for A, because they're our long-term client, and we'll assist B in transitioning to new counsel. In that kind of a scenario, if both parties consent, I think, you know, you have a pretty good argument that it's okay to stay on as counsel for client A and transition client B to new counsel, and you make sure that everybody understands what that means, and you know, assist as we're required to under the ethics rules. But in the absence of one of those sorts of agreements, you know, the default is that you're probably going to have to withdraw on behalf of all of the clients, because you can't get meaningful waivers when you're in the middle of a dispute. You know, that's sort of the whole point of that, you know, getting the consents up front, because when everybody's mad at each other, they're certainly not going to agree that, you know, A gets to keep you as lawyer and B has to go find someone else. It's highly, highly improbable. I mean, and this is playing out right now. In Georgia, just a few weeks ago in late April, the Fulton County District Attorney filed a motion to disqualify, the attorney for 10 of the, Georgia electors who were certifying the election back in 2020, because, the DA is alleging that there's a conflict. It's non-consentable because the clients have started blaming each other for, the crimes that they're accused of. So if the clients are now at the point where they're pointing fingers at their co-client in the same representation, I mean, that is generally considered an issue that a lawyer cannot navigate anymore, because your duty of loyalty to every client requires you to zealously represent each and every one of those clients. And this is in the, you know, the current press. So it's something that you can find out about, just by, you know, a Google search, but these things happen, particularly in criminal matters, and particularly in matters where the issues are kind of sensitive and parties may not necessarily always get along, but, you know, whether this attorney will ultimately withdraw, time will tell. But, you know, these are things to consider at the outset. So with the few minutes we have left, I'll let Tom talk about negotiation ethics, and then we'll open up for questions.
Great. Thanks, Liz. Let me just take a few minutes and if you had one more complication, in case you weren't already kind of dazed by how complicated this all is and the importance of, like I said, rubbing your clients, all the joint clients' nose in the both the loyalty and the information flow decisions that they make with your guidance, thanks to Liz's good explanation. And that is what's called the aggregate settlement rule, which is doesn't make any sense the way it's written. And I think eventually, Liz, I don't know what you think. I think eventually it will be recognized to not make any sense and it'll change. But it's in Rule 1.8 of the ABA model rules and probably every one of your state's rules. And it says a lawyer who represents two or more clients, that's all we got today, shall not participate in making an aggregate settlement, I'll explain what that is in a minute, of the claims of or against the clients, or in a criminal case, an aggregated amount as to guilt, agreement rather, as the guilt or nolo contendere plea. And let me explain now what an aggregate settlement is. If you've got joint clients, and let's say you've got 10 plaintiffs suing the same defendant, and the defendant reaches out and says, listen, I'll give $1,000 to whoever wants to settle. Either in or you're out, that's fine. You know, five of you say, okay, I'll pay you. And then we got another five still keep going. That's not an aggregate settlement. An aggregate settlement is when the defendant says, listen, I want to get rid of all of your case, all 10 of your cases. Let's say there's 10 plaintiffs. I'm going to give $100,000 and everybody's in or there's no deal. In other words, I want everybody in or else I'm not going to settle with anybody. That makes an aggregate settlement. And 1.8 says you can't do that, that this lawyer representing the plaintiffs can't agree to that unless each client gives informed consent in a writing signed by the client to a settlement. The lawyer's disclosure to all 10 of the clients, in my example, shall include the existence and nature of all the claims or pleas involved and the participation of each person in the settlement. And that's been interpreted to mean what money each of them get. And so, which makes some sense, but it should be, I think, the participation in maybe a process by which the money will be divvied up. And you can imagine how difficult this is to deal with when you've got a thousand plaintiffs, because there's some pollution case or something. Theoretically, all thousand have to know what all the other 999 are getting, what money they're getting. And that does not allow it to settle with a $20 million lump sum, which then some expert divvies up later on. I think that's going to change. The academics are pushing it to change. But as it is now, if you represent multiple clients or you are adverse to jointly represented clients from the defense side and the plaintiff represents multiple clients, you have to understand this aggregate settlement rule and the severity of it. And for instance, let me give an example. For instance, let's say you got five clients, one of them, and you're going to get a third contingent fee or the plaintiff's lawyer, and one of them holds out and says, you know, I just want more money. I think it's an ethics violation, Liz. I hope you agree with me, maybe not, for the lawyer to say, okay, I'm going to sweeten your pot. I'll give up some of my fee for you. I'll give you another $25,000. Will that get you to sign on? And then I got a settlement. I think you have to tell the other four that you're sweetening the pot for the one. And that makes some sense given the community, the information flow that Liz has been talking about. So when you negotiate on behalf of joint clients or against somebody, a lawyer who represents joint clients, keep this aggregate settlement rule in mind. Lawyers have lost their license, as Liz talked about disciplinary actions, because they didn't comply with it. They didn't treat everybody. They didn't explain exactly what each one was going to get. And so be really careful with that. It's an impediment to settlements in these mass tort litigations because the as class actions get harder and harder to pursue. So, Stephanie, let's go to questions. If you wish to ask a question, please press the star. Oh, that's you. Okay. I'm going to turn it over to you, Stephanie, to explain that.
If you wish to ask a question, okay, please press the star key on your touchtone phone, place in line. To get out of the queue, just press the pound sign. When prompted for your question, please be brief.
Okay, let me go back to you, Liz, if I can. I'd love your thoughts about the Yardgren settlement rule, if you don't mind giving it to me, because to me it's one of the most fascinating things where the rule doesn't make a lot of sense and has been interpreted in a way that I think kind of gums up the system. Do you have any thoughts about that, or any other concluding thoughts?
No, I think you're right. I mean, I think it does make it complicated, but that's, again, I hate to go back to the beginning and say, this really goes back to that fundamental, what does the lawyer have to think about when they decide to take on a joint group? And settlement is one of those things. Because you have to look out for the best interests of everybody. And I think you're right when you gave the scenario of whether it would be an ethics violation for the lawyer to give up some of their fee to kind of sweeten the pot for the holdout. Yeah, I mean, I think that it would be a problem if it wasn't disclosed. And then, why wouldn't the other attorneys or the other clients just say, yeah, sweeten my pot too. I don't want to settle anymore either. So yeah, I think they need to rethink that aggregate rule, but I think the onus is going to be on lawyers to have kind of thought through to the end game about what could happen too. I hope that answered your question.
Well, it does. I think we're on the same page there, which is good. So, Stephanie, any questions? If there aren't any questions, I'll close it up.
There are no questions at this time.
Great. Okay. Well, I'll let you do your job there. Sorry, it intruded earlier. That's all the time we have for today, folks. If we're not able to ask your question or what occurs to you later, Liz's my contact information has been provided in the written materials. And I'm Tom Spahn. On behalf of Liz Simon and myself, thank you very much for joining us today.
On behalf of the Professional Education Broadcast Network, thank you for listening. This concludes today's broadcast.